This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In June 2016, following the massacre at Pulse, the gay nightclub in Orlando, then-candidate Donald Trump pledged his support as a friend of LGBT people. In comparison to his opponent, Hillary Clinton, he characterized himself as the better friend to gays and said, "Someday I believe that will be proven out big league." But in March, President Trump repealed an Obama-era executive order known as the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Order, which required contractors working with the federal government to demonstrate they have complied with laws barring discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. Last month, the president tweeted his plan to stop transgender individuals from serving in the military. And recently, Trump's Justice Department told a federal appeals court that discrimination based on sexual orientation is legal under federal law. Previously, federal courts had ruled the Civil Rights Act did not cover discrimination based on sexual orientation, but this past spring, an appeals court disagreed, saying that the law does, in fact, afford such protection. This sets all this up for a trip to the Supreme Court. Clearly, the culture wars are back on. Exactly what protections exist in the workplace for LGBT workers? What is the likelihood that the courts would get involved with an official transgender ban for military service? We've invited four experts to address those questions and more this hour. We examine the legal and civil rights aspects of this in a moment, but we start in the workplace. Kenny Colbert is president of the Employers Association, a 60-year-old company which provides HR and training to 950 organizations in the Charlotte area alone. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Colbert is in our Spirit Square studio, and Salise Berry is founder and CEO of Out and Equal Workplace Advocates, and she joins us by phone. Good morning, Salise.
Good morning.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where we're broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning, or you can get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Kenny, let me begin with you. The Obama, President Obama's executive order was overturned by President Trump, and that executive order, President Obama's order, appeared only to apply to companies doing business with the federal government. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Was there anything in place anywhere that you know of for private business?
Well, interesting. When Title VII of the Civil Rights Act was being debated back in 1964, sex was a late entry, and they never really defined what sex meant, including sex discrimination. And that evolved in the courts over the years. So we've had various court rulings that would offer protections. But then, more importantly, back about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the EEOC and OSHA both came out with rulings offering protections. And the EEOC said blatantly that sexual orientation and gender identity are protected classes under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
You work with companies and advise them on human resources issues. This must be an issue that comes up. How often does it come up?
Oh, it comes up. Well, not all. It's a frequent deal. It's not an everyday deal, but we hear about this every week or so from some member companies. And it's typically smaller companies that maybe don't have a sophisticated HR department.
And what do they want to know when they ask you questions about this?
Well, go back a year ago, the big issue was bathroom issues under House Bill 2, what they had to do related to that. But now it comes down to regarding hiring and firing. You know, are these people protected under the laws or not? And so there is some confusion because you have one ruling that says, yes, they are protected. Another ruling says they are not protected. Mm-hmm. And it varies according to the circuits.
Salise Berry, your organization pretty much says exactly what you do, Out and Equal Workplace Advocates. As you go around the country, how comfortable are most employees who are gay or transgender or bi, how comfortable are they being out in the workplace?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, given that 20 years ago I started Out in Equal, because there was no federal law to protect us, I went company by company to make sure that the private sector had policies in place, internal policies, so that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people could be out and equal at work. And here we are 20 years later, still no federal law to protect us. But I see our work as twofold. We're working with the Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies to make sure their internal policies allow people to bring all of who we are to work. And we work with the LGBT community itself to give them resources, tools, and get them comfortable telling their story, because it's our stories that are changing hearts and minds. And people, more and more people are coming out at work all the time, which is changing the workplace and changing society.
So if a company comes to you, Kenny, and says, we are politically or morally or religiously opposed to working with gay people, what do you tell them about formulating their human resources policy? Do you tell them that's a bad idea because you're going to get in trouble, or they're not going to get in trouble because there are no mandates?
We tell them what the EEOC stance on that is, that gender identity and sexual orientation are protected categories. And if they try to write policies to exclude them, they could be charged with discrimination, and they would probably have a difficult battle winning that in front of the EEOC.
When we bring our two attorneys in here, we're going to talk about the battle between the EEOC and the Justice Department, which are taking opposing points of view on this. According to a survey last year from the Public Religion Research Institute, 80% of Americans thought that there is a law protecting LGBT people in the workplace. Solis, could that impression actually be helping LGBT people already in the workplace?
Well, I think it certainly helps when people assume that they can't discriminate, but it's also, I think, a surprise for so many people that we're not protected, that we live in this interesting time where we can be married on Saturday in 50 states, and then yet in 28 states, we can still be fired on Monday for putting our wedding picture on our desk. So the fact that there is no federal law to protect us, states go, we have to go state by state to have those laws. And of course, working with companies who really understand that discrimination is just not good for business.
Why? Explain to that. I've heard that term so many times, that discrimination is not good for business. And some major companies like Bank of America, like Wells Fargo, has said that as well in the public, that it's not good for business. We're going to be open and honest, and we're going to be welcoming. Why is it not good for business?
Well, first of all, there's a war on talent, as everyone knows. So if you're excluding any part of the population and you're trying to recruit and retain the brightest and the best and leaving out a huge population of people, then that's just in and of itself not a good business practice. The LGBT community is, of course, a market, a pretty significant market, early adopters. And so if you are doing business to the LGBT community, that's also a positive change. And then just anecdotally, I mean, people being, if you come into work every day and you put all of your energy into hiding who you are, changing pronouns when you talk about your life or your weekend, you're not putting that same energy into being successful in your career, into your job, into the bottom line. So just getting people on board and feeling comfortable and being able to be bring all of who they are to work makes a difference for the employee and the employer.
I don't know whether this question should go to you, Solis, or to Kenny, so I'll let you fight over it. It would be accurate to say that the thrust, the movement toward gay rights or LGBT rights in the workplace is coming primarily, or at least being led, by major corporations versus ma and pa's?
I would certainly say that, because their reputation is on the line in the public relations image. You know, Wells Fargo, Bank of America make the news every day. The little manufacturing company on the corner with 40 employees does not make the news. So if there's going to be a change, it's going to have to come from the Fortune 500 side of the business, not the mom-and-pop side of the business.
So how do you work with these smaller organizations? Go ahead. Go ahead, Solis.
I would just add that when I started out in Equal 20 years ago, only 4% of Fortune 500 companies had any protection for LGBT people. And now that number is like 96%. So only 4% don't include some kind of protection. So I obviously attribute a lot of that to the work of Out in Equal, but certainly the corporations, multinational companies, the private sector has led the way, definitely. And it was only during the President Obama's administration that the government started catching up with where Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies have led us.
Well, you're making the conservative argument that if you let the marketplace work, it will solve the problem. We don't need government intervention. How do you feel about that?
Well, I just feel like government needs to lead the way. And what we're seeing and talking about this morning is that it just began leading the way and now it's kind of faltering, certainly on LGBT issues. But I think that there's still a long way to go, obviously, with even within the culture of Fortune 500 companies, but the policies are in place and they just recognize the importance of including LGBT people in the business arena.
Kenny Colbert, aside from last year when we were all dealing with the fallout from HB2, does there seem to be discomfort in the workplace among the people that you, the companies that you work with? Is this something that they want to get, a hurdle they want to get over, they want to provide these protections, or is it just a hassle to have to provide these protections?
Well, I think the majority of companies out there want to provide protections. There's a very small percentage that don't, and those are the ones that make the news, the ones who don't want to play fairly and play by the rules, et cetera. Again, it's an interesting debate. I had a conversation yesterday with someone over minimum wage. Should the federal government set minimum wage or should the market set minimum wage? Should the federal government write rules about protections or should the marketplace set that? It's going to be an argument. It's going to be debated for a while.
So you've had this great success, Solis. You mentioned 20 years ago, less than 4% of Fortune 500 companies had LGBT protections, and now 4% are the ones that don't provide those protections. And you kind of gave a lot of the credit to your own organization for this. So what was the impetus for them to change? Just you beating the drum? Was it social pressures? Was it more people in the workplace coming out and they realized, hey, this person that I've worked with for 10 years is gay. It's not the boogeyman. I guess it's okay. What do you attribute the change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a huge part of it is that people get to know Maria and she's this fabulous marketing person. And oh, by the way, she happens to be a lesbian. It's not like, let's run screaming from the room. You just kind of get to know people as people. But it was really just a day in and day out, again, kind of visiting companies, but also bringing people together. We have the Out and Equal Workplace Summit is our biggest event every year. We also have smaller events around the country and in fact, around the world. Bringing people together for peer-to-peer education. This is how we got these policies in our company. This is how you can get them as well. Our first summit had 200 people, and our last summit had close to 5,000 people from about over 40 countries. And we're meeting again in Philadelphia in October, but bringing together that many people that are committed to LGBT workplace equality and able to share their best practices of how they made a difference has really propelled us forward. But it's really, it comes down to LGBT people feeling comfortable with in their skin and being able to talk about their lives and telling their story that really has made a huge difference.
Solis Berry is founder and CEO of an organization called Out and Equal Workplace Advocates. She's here along with Kenny Colbert, president of the Employers Association. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the legal aspects of all this. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Central Piedmont Community College, offering an information session August 17th for the Certified Financial Planner Certification Education Program. Details at 704-330-4681. And Northeast Digestive Health Center, the practice is expanding to help support the growing community. A second location at Edison Square in Concord will be open this summer to serve patients, GI needs. More info at northeastdigestive.com. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County says no to funding a soccer stadium, choosing only to provide the land. A panel of federal judges rules that GOP leaders in the legislature have 1 month to redraw 28 voting districts. UNC's Board of Governors considers barring university centers and institutes from engaging in litigation. And the PGA Championship is heading to Charlotte. Or those stories and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
Unemployment is pretty low. Good for workers, not so good for employers.
Now we spend thousands of dollars in recruitment costs a month, and we can't find enough people to fill our interview sheets.
I'm Kai Risdahl. The full employment dilemma and the rest of today's business news next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about LGBT workplace issues. Kenny Colbert is here, president of the Employers Association, and Celise Berry, founder and CEO of Out and Equal Workplace Advocates. As we've been talking, we've had some listeners chime in. Christy on Twitter says, discrimination is bad for business because folks will expose a business on social media and hurt their profits. Karen on Facebook, why should it matter who people love or what their gender is? Can they do the job? If so, good, leave folks alone. Is that the new prevailing attitude, Celise, as you go around the country? Has that become the prevailing attitude?
Well, I would just say the people that I'm in conversation with have said, you know, that LGBT equality is really baked into the DNA of the culture of their company, and that they're not just leaving people alone necessarily, but recognizing that LGBT people have a unique perspective on our own community and marketing to our community. And if we're able to show up authentically, that we have so much to offer, and people recognize that, and just as they're recognizing that people are different racial, ethnic backgrounds and genders and religions, that they're different sexual orientations, and that we need to embrace that in order to be a healthy, authentic workplace.
So right now in North Carolina, when you talk to companies, Kenny, what do you tell them is in place in terms of protections in the workplace? What kinds of protections are there for anybody, for women, for men, for gay people, for straight people, for African Americans? What do you tell them?
We tell them by all means, as they're writing their policies, to include sexual orientation and gender identity in their policies. And they're always, of course, going to look for the most qualified applicant and hire the most qualified person. You know, if you follow the laws when you're interviewing someone.
And how do you know that bias is not coming into play?
Well, if you're following the laws, you're not asking questions that are more personal in nature that would lead them to answer the question, yes, I'm gay or I'm bi or something like this. I hear stories all the time of we have a talented person working for us and they've been here for 3 months or for 3 years and I just found out that they're gay. I mean, that's the way the process should work. Mm-hmm. Is it doesn't come up in the interview process, and it just happens to come out in conversations later on.
We're going to widen this discussion now to include the law as it currently exists in the United States. Luke Largesse is a partner at Tin Fulton Walker and Owen. Mr. Largesse was one of the lead lawyers in the case which successfully overturned this state's ban on same-sex marriage. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us by phone is Ted Shaw, the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director for the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good morning. Luke, let me begin with you. Why don't civil rights protections that are already in the law apply to LGBT people automatically?
Well, as Kenny mentioned, the Civil Rights Act, when it was adopted, only had sex as the one word in it.
And that's the
wrong
word, isn't it?
Well, it's because
I mean, should
it's
it be gender?
Right. Well, it's evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the courts, to me, in my view, mirror society. They don't lead it.
Okay.
And what you've seen both with the marriage issue, you know, the issue, the legal arguments for gay marriage were first presented to the Supreme Court in 1971, and the same arguments won in 2016. So the law and society evolves, and the thing that's happened here, the two kind of foundational cases, and if I could just take a minute, because I think it's important for people to know this, and they're both very interesting. In 1986, a woman who was up for partner at Price Waterhouse had just gotten the largest sort of client award of any associate had ever done in the company. It was passed over for partnership, ended up that she was passed over because she was not feminine enough, that she cussed, they didn't like the way she dressed, kind of thing. And that went up to the Supreme Court. It's called Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins. And the court, 6-3, said that's gender stereotyping is covered by Title VII. So that was kind of one of the opening doors where sex became broader. The second was this case, I think in 1997, a guy named Ankali, who was a oil rig worker in the Gulf and tiny guy. And he was literally, he had soap pushed up his anus by the crew when he was in the shower. And he filed a complaint with the company and they would do nothing. So he quit and sued. Mm-hmm. And Justice Scalia wrote an opinion that Title VII covered same-sex harassment like that. And so it's those two cases that have led the courts to start to evolve to say that sex is broader than just traditional biological birth sex.
So Title VII is part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it focused on job placement and termination. Correct me if I'm wrong about all this, because I know nothing, but it focused on job placement and termination and that you couldn't terminate someone because of their gender. That's correct.
Right.
Okay. So how have the courts historically been interpreting Title VII as it relates to sexual orientation?
Well, those two cases I just mentioned are sort of the opening of the door, and the Supreme Court thing that the EEOC ruling that Kenny mentioned, mm-hmm. it sort of has these three points that gender discrimination based on sexual orientation is necessarily based on sex. Two, that it's associational discrimination. If you fire someone because they're married to someone of the same sex, you're firing them like you would fire someone because they're married to a person of the opposite race. Mm-hmm. And third, that this notion of gender stereotyping that came out of that Hopkins case in 1986. So that's where the EEOC came from. But that was a 3-2 commission decision. One of those commissioners has stepped down. It's now 2-2, and Trump's going to fill that fifth commission slot. And so they could flip. Just like the Justice Department has flipped.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong again, but aren't the federal courts, the appeals courts, split on interpretation of Title VII?
They are, and people need to understand that process. To get to the Supreme Court, there's 11 circuits, and within each circuit, the cases are heard by a panel of three, and the panel of three is stuck by the precedent. So in many of the courts, this precedent was that sex was limited to just traditional sex. Mm-hmm. So there have been these series of what's called en banc, where the entire court has to sit to overturn a prior decision. The Seventh Circuit, the one that Solis mentioned the comment about marrying on Saturday and getting fired on Monday, that comes out of that decision in April. And the Second Circuit decision that Trump announced this week, Trump and Sessions announced this week, that they're filing against the EEOC in the same case.
Yes, we're going to talk about that.
Right. and it's because that's an en banc decision because the Second Circuit right now, which is New York, Vermont, and Connecticut federal courts, they still have this prior case saying that they don't recognize sexual orientation discrimination.
So, Ted Shaw, you're a civil rights expert, and you've been working in this area for much of your career. What parallels do you see here between the struggle of employees for LGBT rights and the rights of transgendered individuals, et cetera, to serve in the military versus the struggle for African-American rights?
Well, one of the things that has happened over the last 50 years is that we as a country have been evolving in our understanding of discrimination. And as a general rule, I think the majority of Americans now believe, not all Americans, but majority of Americans believe that it's wrong to discriminate against people because of who or what they are, what they believe in, whom they love, those kinds of things. On the issue of sexual orientation, that's been growing, and it's been growing in recent years in ways that many people wouldn't have anticipated, for example, with the understanding about the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause and other constitutional dimensions with respect to same-sex marriage, et cetera. Justice Kennedy's opinions took the court and was a deciding vote. In a direction many people wouldn't have anticipated. I think that for many African Americans, and I've written about this in editorial pieces, there are some people who have thought that civil rights is something that belonged exclusively to Black folk in terms of articulating this struggle, and that others, and particularly the LGBT community should get their own struggle, so to speak, and have their own terminology and language. But I think anybody who does this work understands that that's much too short-sighted. Most of us have gone beyond that and have an understanding about discrimination as being wrong if people are subjected to it because of who and what they are.
So
I think there's a lot of common ground among civil rights leaders in the African-American community and people in the LGBT community, even if it's not completely common.
So when the Trump administration or the Trump Justice Department argues that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act does not include sexual orientation, and they inserted themselves into this federal case and filed an amicus brief in New York involving two private parties, and no government agencies involved in this suit, how unusual is that move for the government to get involved in that way in a civil rights action?
Well, it is, I wouldn't describe it as usual, but it's not completely unheard of also. I mean, the government, can try to intervene or file an amicus brief depending on the case, and has done so where it hasn't been a party to the case in the past. I can recall during the Reagan administration, when there was a change of position with respect to the prior administration. Maybe I got that wrong. It was actually the Bush administration, and it was in a case that involved employment issues in which the Clinton administration had been coming in favor of the plaintiff who was suing for discrimination. And that was a change of governmental position, but because the government had been consulting with in the prior administration with the parties, they were disqualified. In this case, we have another instance in which the government wants to come in and take a position. It is proactive. They could have stayed out of it. They could have filed their own cases or filed an amicus brief when the case reached the Supreme Court, as they often do. But this is an activist administration, and it's a conservative activist administration. So I, for one, am not surprised.
Okay. So in reporting on this, Luke, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote that the Trump Justice Department's position does not differ greatly from the department under President Obama, whose Justice Department in 2014 sought to dismiss a suit by a fired gay employee of the Library of Congress. So would you agree with that assessment, that it's not that different?
Well, no, actually, that's a little bit out of sequence, because there was a Justice Department position that for many years that evolved, and actually right after that 2014, Eric Holder came out with a new position. That's what's sort of interesting here, is that the Justice Department and the EEOC around the same time came out with the same position that sexual orientation should be covered by Title VII. And now, so the EEOC is going around, like I said, to these en banc cases and filing friends of the court brief because they want to take that, know their position. Now the Department of Justice is flipping and taking the opposite position.
Indeed, because the Obama administration backed away from that position in a later case, and an Obama-appointed majority of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, voted in 2015 to define anti-gay discrimination as illegal sex discrimination. Now, Trump's lawyers are saying the EEOC is not speaking, this is a quote, is not speaking for the United States.
Right.
I have one question. What? How can that be? How can we have two departments at odds with each other in the same administration?
Well, there are a lot of how can that be questions going around right now. So I, and this is just an example of one of them. And just to understand the argument, it's a pretty straightforward one that actually was in part of HB2 that people lost sight of because it was all about the bathrooms.
Yeah.
But the argument is simple, like Kenny said, that when Title VII was passed, sex was inserted there. There was no sort of discussion about what that meant. And there have been numerous attempts by some in Congress to amend Title VII to include sexual orientation expressly, and it's been denied. So their argument is Congress never intended sexual orientation to be covered because it's never passed the law. And that's the simple argument that is now being made.
So actually sex was added to Title VII at the last minute to try to kill the whole bill. Someone said if they throw sex in there, that will just throw Title VII out the door, so it was a late entry. But then if you look into the late 60s, all of the cases that were involving sex were typically, this is a man's job, this is a woman's job. Those were the cases. As Luke just said, it was in the 1970s and 80s before we ever saw cases related to any type of harassment. Harassment was not even mentioned in 1964. So, it was simply men's job versus women's job.
So, Solis, when the water is so muddy, and it's being muddied even as we speak, how does that impact you and people in the workplace that you're working for and the people in the workplace who need to be convinced to your point of view?
Well, I think it certainly reminds people how important it is to have policies, and it really begs the question, like, the need for a federal law to protect the LGBT community. And for many, many years, since 94, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act came forward time and time again. But I feel like it's, you know, now that's pretty much dead, and now the Equality Act has been presented, but it needs something needs to happen so that we can actually be protected, so that the government does catch up with the business community who continues to say this is the right thing to do.
So, Ted, I have 2 minutes left in this segment. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 bars discrimination in the workplace based on, quote, race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. It does not specifically, as is mentioned here, does not specifically mention sexual orientation or gender orientation. So what would have to happen to remove all doubt? Would legislation have to be passed to include those terms, or would the Supreme Court simply have to say it includes those things?
Well, either one of those two things would do it, or could do it. Certainly, if Congress expressed itself through legislation, that would clarify things, although then there's always a question about whether that legislation is constitutional, because I'm sure there would be a challenge. Ultimately, of course, it's the Supreme Court that decides what the law is and how the Constitution applies. This could be addressed through statutory or constitutional schemes, with the Supreme Court having a final say.
And in its brief, the Justice Department noted that every Congress since 1974 has declined to add sexual orientation provisions to Title VII, despite what it called notable changes in societal and cultural attitudes. And the brief also mentions the substantial and unique interest of the government in the proper interpretation of Title VII. I only have 40 seconds, but what does that mean?
Well, that's what I was just explaining. That's the simple argument against what sex means.
But I mean, what does it mean that the government have substantial and unique interest in the proper interpretation of that?
There's this whole notion, it's under a case called Chevron versus NRDC, where the courts have to defer to the federal agencies that are interpreting their own law, the statutes that they regulate. And there's actually always, every year there's a bill passed to take away Chevron deference, but it's... that's what they mean by that. They should defer to the Justice Department. Now, the problem here is that the EEOC has the opposite position.
Okay. Luke Larges is a partner with Tin Fulton Walker, and Owen Ted Shaw is a professor of law and the director of the Center for Civil Rights at UNC. And we have other guests as well. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Baby & Company, a modern birth center offering individualized maternity and well-woman care classes and wellness services in an intimate setting. More information available at babyandcompany.com. Sweeping changes to America's immigration system were unveiled yesterday at the White House. The tweaks would cut in half the number of legal immigrants coming into the United States and would mark a break from decades of bipartisan consensus on immigration. Democrats and Republicans already say the proposal is a non-starter. So, during On Point, coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock, they'll talk about how the immigration revamp would remake America. That's just ahead. We will continue our conversation about LGBT rights in the workplace in just a moment, and you can email us to participate at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Few countries have taken in more Syrian refugees than Lebanon. Lebanese Prime Minister...
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The North Carolina Constitution states that when drawing state legislative maps, counties should be left whole.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about LGBT equal protections in the workplace in light of recent moves by the Trump administration, both at the Justice Department and through Twitter with the president talking about military service. Kenny Colbert is here. He's the president of the Employers Association. Selise Berry is founder and CEO Out and Equal Workplace Advocates. Luke Largess is a partner with Tin Fulton Walker and Owen, and Ted Shaw is the Julius Chambers Professor, Distinguished Professor of Law, and the Director for the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Charlotte. You wanted to bring HB2 back into this conversation because it's germane to this conversation,
right? Because it's not just a federal issue, and this was sort of lost in all the public discussion about the bathroom aspect of the bill. But North Carolina has a statute called NCEPA is its short name, but it's a public policy that says you can't discriminate on the basis of race, sex, national origin, religion. It's sort of Title VII language as an in losing your job in North Carolina. So you have what's called a wrongful discharge claim. Mm-hmm. HB2 inserted the word biological in front of sex in that statute to tell the courts they could not consider gender orientation or sexual orientation. And it's a very, very parallel to all this. It was at the state level, what's sort of the discussion going on. But it was an effort by the legislature to tell the courts that they couldn't follow this development. And I think, getting back to what you asked both Selise and Ted, the society is evolving. And the courts, I think, you know, if you look back to 2012 when Amendment 1 was passed in North Carolina, people would have thought it was crazy that within 2 years a court would be striking it down. Mm. But the law developed quickly.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that same thing now on this workplace stuff. I think the law in the next couple of years is going to develop very quickly to establish that you have these protections.
I'm told that I just said that Ted Shaw was a professor of law at UNC Charlotte. He's, in fact, a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. I didn't know there was a university in Chapel Hill. How long has that been there, Ted? some say that the battle for LGBT rights in the workplace is being entwined with sex discrimination because in June the EEOC argued that sexual orientation-based discrimination is by definition based on sex and involved sex stereotyping, which has long been prohibited by the Supreme Court. Ted Shaw, is that going to be seen as a valid point of view?
Well, I think that, that issue has also been argued, for some time now that the word sex, as we talked about earlier, as used in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that was a time in which our understanding of the dimensions of sex and sexuality, et cetera, was not what it is now. When I said sexuality, the act was not about sex or as amended itself, but rather about gender. And our understanding of gender has grown also. So I think that argument will continue to be part of what the courts hear or will be presented to the court, I should say, as these matters proceed through the courts, as the federal government tries to push under the Trump administration against the idea of protecting LGBT communities and individuals against discrimination based upon their sexual orientation. So no doubt the language is going to be part of it.
So I think you just answered Guy's email question. He asked, what was the definition for sex, the word sex, when the Civil Rights Act was created, and what legal basis does the court have now to change that definition? So the second part of that question may be new, but you're saying that the definition for sex was really gender in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. What about a legal basis to change or broaden that definition? Where would that come from?
Well, it comes from what we talked about before, these Supreme Court decisions, one saying that gender stereotyping was a form of sex discrimination,
right,
and then another saying that sexual harassment was protected. So there's sort of the courts have evolved. What does that term encompass? Not what's its definition, but what does it encompass?
Selise, when you hear conversations like this and you watch what's going on in Washington as we change administrations and the administrations change points of view on this issue, do you feel like it's one step forward, two steps back, or do you see a steady stair step of progress here?
Yeah, a little of both, obviously, but we're definitely, you know, continuing overall, I think, moving in a positive direction. But it just reminds me of, you know, the struggle that so many HR professionals had for so many years around marriage, because there were civil unions in some states and some states had marriage. And finally, when marriage equality happened overall, it leveled the playing field. And no one, I mean, certainly the LGBT community was celebrating when so was the HR community, thinking, finally, we have one law for all of our employees all over the country. But some of it also gets down to, you know, the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity. Sexual orientation is really about who we love, and gender identity is really about who we are.
Right.
And as our colleagues were saying, it's evolving, and all of this conversation is evolving, even to the point where many companies and workplaces are starting to talk about fluidity. It's not just this is a man and this is a woman, or this is a transgender man and a transgender woman. What about people, you know, that are gender fluid? So there's all kinds of complexities that make my work interesting.
But talk about the complexity here for a second, Kenny, because one of the arguments throughout the history of these developments has been that when you foist all of this off on workplace folks, bosses, human resources executives, et cetera, that this is just making things too darn complicated. Has it complicated things, or is it fairly clear now to people that it doesn't matter?
It's really not that complicated in the workplace on a day-to-day basis. It's just complicated from a legal standpoint, trying to understand what the law really says. But I hear very little about harmonious relationships in the workplace concerning this. There are very, very few problems that take place on a day-to-day basis because of having people in the workplace like this. Where the problems come is you have the one rogue case that makes the news. The courts take that upon it, and then all the publicity goes to that.
Yeah.
But 99% of the companies out there have no issues with this on a day-to-day basis.
I mentioned, Luke, that you were one of the lead lawyers in the case which successfully overturned North Carolina's ban on same-sex marriage. Are the arguments being made against worker protections the same, or are they similar, or only similar to those that were being made about same-sex marriage?
Well, it's a little different legally, because what you're really talking about, other than the orders about federal employees, are you're talking about regulating private employer conduct, as opposed to marriage, which was regulating governmental control over marriage. So there were equal protection and due process claims in the marriage cases that don't apply in the Title VII type cases. Here, it's more this notion. And I will comment, piggyback a little bit on what Solis just said. There are more circuits that have found gender orientation, transgender, sort of protected by Title VII than sexual orientation right now, which isn't just numerically. There's about four. But I do think this is evolving, and I think I'm very optimistic. I think in a few years we're going to have sort of this resolved.
Speaking of transgender individuals, the Justice Department inserted themselves, as I said, into that New York case on the same day that President Trump tweeted that transgender people would no longer be allowed to serve in the military. The Pentagon responded by saying essentially that a tweet is not a formal directive and that nothing would change until a formal directive is issued. And so far, that directive has not been issued. Once you allow, though, a certain class of people to serve, as President Obama did when he put the current policy in place, can you rescind it, or does that raise all sorts of legal issues, Ted? Or do civilian legal issues really apply within the military? Is that a separate organization or a separate thing all unto itself? Ted?
Well, you know, if something is done through executive order, you know, it's obviously possible to change the executive order or to issue a new executive order. And so, you know, that's the reality of it. You know, if it's done through legislation, that's different. Can this president attempt to, through executive order, undo what President Obama did? Yes, he can try to do that. The wisdom of it is another question. But he didn't do it by executive order. He did it or attempted to do it by tweet, which, of course, heard of.
Yes, but it gives you an insight into what the president is thinking. He may come back with an actual directive that does overturn this. So if that were to happen, could it happen?
Your question is whether or not he can issue a new executive order that undoes what President Obama did, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Then the question becomes whether or not this is discrimination which can survive judicial scrutiny.
Is this one of the last areas, Luke, in this LGBT panoply of issues that will be decided? And when this is decided, will that put this all to rest and we move on to something else?
Well, you wonder. I mean, there's vestiges of race discrimination in the society still, even though we have all these laws that people recognize and accept. So, that, you know, there will be problems for a long time. I think both the gender identity, sexual orientation issues are so generational. I think that people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, it's not an issue, except for some who have fairly conservative religious orientation, perhaps. But for, you know, you look at the statistics, this is kind of an evolution of the society, and the courts are mirroring that, and we're going to get that settled, I think. Mm-hmm. I think this tweet is going to open a hornet's nest of litigation if they try to tell trans people they can't serve in the military after they have successful and earned all the stuff.
That was the intent of my question. Yeah. Yes, he can, as the president, yes, he can do that. Right. But can he really do that? Oh, what would happen if he did it?
I think he's inviting a firestorm of litigation on that.
Do you think he really meant that, or do you think that was a diversionary tactic that took our minds off something else?
I think both that issue and the decision to file in the Second Circuit are both sort of time to kind of take attention away from other things.
You know, you said, Solis, in writing, in an article that I read yesterday, that no one should be forced to choose between the career they love and who they love. And it's a lesson, you said, that you learned the hard way 20 years ago. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Sure, yes. I actually went to San Francisco Theological Seminary to be a Presbyterian minister and couldn't get ordained as an out lesbian. And was very not thrilled with that reality and tried to figure out what I would do with my life. And spent a lot of time trying to figure that out, and finally, eventually, with that commitment that no one, like you just said, should ever have to choose between the career that we love and the person that we love, took that energy and passion and started out in Equal Workplace Advocates, and have seen it grow and continue to do this work day in and day out so that everyone can be out and equal at work.
Is it likely in your mind, Kenny, that the private sector will actually handle this, whether or not the government ever gets a decision or changes the codes on the books, et cetera, that the private sector will take care of this and we'll move on?
Yes. This is a big public relations issue, and companies have to do the right thing to maintain their employee morale, their reputation in the community, to attract new employees, to attract investors, et cetera. So to a large degree, the employers are going to do the right thing.
I want to completely change gears here for a second, Ted Shaw, because a UNC System Board of Governor committee said on Tuesday that the university system should bar the UNC Chapel Hill Law School Center for Civil Rights from taking on new clients. Do you understand the motivation for that?
Well, first, it has the effect of barring the center, if this is adopted by the full board, from taking on new clients. But the proposition itself is that the center cannot be involved in bringing civil rights cases, or for that matter, even working with others who do civil rights cases or referring cases. And so it's an extraordinary measure with respect to its reach and depth and breadth. And so do I understand the motivation? I think I do. I can't peer into the hearts of the individual who, Steve Long, who has been driving this, but clearly he's not somebody who cares much about civil rights protections, given our long history in this state and in the university of discrimination against African Americans, people of color, et cetera. But also, this is about academic freedom. It's about what's taught and how it's taught and whether we can have experiential education. And this is an ideological hit, as I said to the Committee of the Board of Governors. That's very clear. I mean, I think that people want to dance around that or pretend that it's something other than that. But that's clearly what it is.
And I have 15. I have 15 seconds, Ted. So just very quickly, because this is a recommendation that will be voted on by the entire board in September. If they pass it, what will the impact on your organization be?
Well, it will mean that the center, as we know it, will not be able to exist to do its work. And the question is whether it can exist at all at UNC Law School. But the work will continue one way or another. I'm sure of that.
Ted Shaw, Julius Chambers Professor of Law and the Director for the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Chapel Hill. Luke Largesse, a partner with Tin Fulton, Walker and Owen. Kenny Colbert, President of the Employers Association. And Celise Berry, Founder and CEO of Out and Equal Workplace Advocates. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production.